On this episode of Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks, I sit down with Spencer Hillegas to uncover the journey of a passive investor.
Hey, Mavericks. This is Ava Baukamp, and this episode of Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks is brought to you by Legacy Impact Investors. We are an industrial investment firm located in cash flow country, the Midwest. We strive to shield off risk and beat inflation, all while producing predictable cash flow. We curate real estate investment opportunities for busy professionals and other real estate investors seeking passive income. To learn more about what we do and connect with me, go to www.legacyimpactinvestors.com.
Maverick, noun, unusual person, a visionary, leader, go-getter, an independent thinker. They see the vision for their life and pull that future towards them. With an unyielding belief that things can and must be better. They achieve what most won't. Innovative, influential, daring, and direct, with a remarkably high tolerance for taking calculated risk. A foe to the status quo. This is Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks. Your host, Neil Timmons, has been involved with over $300 million in real estate transactions. He's a published author, commercial property investor, and real estate syndicator. This show is for those who want to learn how to earn passive income through real estate investing. Now, here's your host, Neil Timmons.
Welcome to Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks, where we provide you actionable steps for you to grow your passive income and become job optional. During this episode, you're going to get to discover the journey of a passive investor. Now, for those of you who are new, I'm your host, Neil Timmons. I love passive income from real estate. Now, before I introduce you to today's Maverick, I want to make a request that at any point during this episode, you like what you hear, well, give us a thumbs up. Be certain to subscribe to the show. Never miss a valuable episode. If you love what you hear, give us a written review. Plus, be sure to look at the description of this episode. We packed it with thousands of dollars in free resources. Now, today, we've got the privilege to learn from a person who became financially free in 5 years from his passive investing journey. Prior to that, he was in fintech out there in the Silicon Valley. But ultimately, it all changed when he got turned on to passive investing in real estate. Now, I would describe today's Maverick as somebody who's passionate about learning and pushing the limits of what he can do in his own life. Today's Maverick, Spencer Hillegas. Spencer, how are you?
Doing great, Neil. Really wonderful to start the day with you here.
I'm excited to have you here. Say, for the audience's sake, who are you? What do you do? Where are you from?
Yeah, so I'm based out here in the Bay Area, California, just north of proper Silicon Valley. I was born and raised here, but never in my life did I expect that I would become somehow a full-time passive investor, as we say, in the investing real estate investing world. So that's what I do these days. I literally just got back, as we were chatting about a moment ago, Neil, from 6 weeks abroad living in Portugal with my whole family and my two young boys, 9 and 5. That kind of lifestyle would have never been possible in my prior career. So I am sitting in Silicon Valley, spent 13 years in tech companies, 5 different financial tech, fintech companies, building operations groups and working my butt off. I would argue too hard, too many hours in hindsight, yeah. 60, 80 hour weeks. So I don't look back that fondly on those, but wonderful journey, learned a lot. And so these days I get to focus on, frankly, investing in many of the assets that you also appreciate just across the country, particularly within the Sun Belt. Multifamily storage. And what I do full time now is invest passively and manage our investing group at Madison Investing. It's a passive investor club. So it's been a wonderful, fun run.
That's great. There's a lot to unpack there. Take me to the real estate side and then I'll get into prior to real estate. But the very first commercial deal that you invested in or bought directly, what was that? When was that?
Yeah. We probably won't go into this today, but I was born and raised in a residential real estate broker household. So that's a different tangent.
Yep.
But that's why I went into tech. I ended up investing in
smart man.
Hey, full circle. I'm still back here in real estate, right?
Yeah.
So it was around 2016. We started buying single family rentals, not including our primary home here in the Bay Area, which is good appreciation, but not an investment. Eventually invest as an LP in around 2017 and then gangbusters from there. So that was in Texas, Dallas, Texas. I think it's the number one, you know, it's a massive market as I've come to learn from many trips out there and investments over the years now, but that was the first one. It was a couple hundred units in Dallas, Texas.
What took you down that LP path to begin with?
We stumbled through these, in hindsight, three phases, and everything is so clear in life when you look back hindsight. Right. But at the time, this felt as clear as mud.
Yep.
Myself and Jennifer, who's my co-founder, investing group, we were working dual careers, her industry, CPG marketing leader, my industry, fintech. We just wanted to go build up beyond our 401ks. We had good incomes. So we started buying rentals. Mm-hmm. Phase one, bought a local duplex. We still have it. It's here in Vallejo, California. Overpaid for it for cash flow. Didn't know what it meant to invest for cash flow. 430 grand, $200 a month in cash flow. Still own it now, but that was a learning lesson, right? Tough learning, tough tuition.
Yep.
Second phase, we bought up to 5 turnkey rental properties. And that was in Kansas City, Missouri, 60K a pop, around $250 a month in cash flow. Way better economics. But then we took our licks. We learned what semi-passive investing in a rental property means. We learned what happens when you invest in C-class and your property turns over the tenant once a year and kills your economics, right? We went through those stages relatively fast. So we got up to about 7 doors, technically, I think, when we were doing the small property investing. And that's when we had realized we have a couple of young kids. I mean, we were working full-time hard, waiting on that equity from those Silicon Valley startups, the unspoken lottery of Silicon Valley.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And maybe one of those 5 companies is still going to have a hit, but I'm not expecting that. So that's what drew us over to finally saying, look, at the time, this is around 2016, I was working in the guts of a established fix and flip lender. I never planned on going into a real estate or a lending company, but I saw the economics. I saw what happened when we were lending to over 600 individual fix and flip properties per month. And I had no interest in that stuff at that time. I had no interest in going deep on the numbers. I had no interest in becoming a full-time real estate investor, active or passive. Mm. But then I saw the numbers and I saw how straightforward it was.
Yeah.
Can't swing a hammer still. I'm not a handy dude. I rely on YouTube every day around the house. I didn't want to go fix and flip. And I saw the horror stories at firsthand. The people I was managing were doing these things on the weekend. And I was like, well, I know how to structure partnerships. I know how to review the spreadsheets. I know how to do the analysis. And I see how many zeros are on these pro formas that these investors are making. I just need something that clicks for me. I need something that looks bigger, more predictable. I'm not going to say corporate because that doesn't reflect it well, but I just need something that I can wrap my head around with predictability and scale. And then I looked at these from reading 24 books in 18 months, overdid it, listened to 400 podcasts, just to educate myself on nights and weekends, got a little obsessed.
Just a little.
I don't think anyone needs to go do that, by the way.
Yeah.
3 books would have been fine. But I really looked at it like, wow, these numbers make sense to me. And yeah, I had to get over that same hurdle I think a lot of us do, which is one door, one property seems less scary than a 200 unit, 300 unit, 400 unit apartment building that's sitting in the middle of Alabama or sitting in the middle of Georgia, sitting in the middle of Texas, and it's hundreds of miles away. And so as soon as that clicked for me and we pulled the trigger on the first one, then it was all over, right? At that point, it was like, well, this seems like it's a really solid model and it does not increase our overhead and we're just too darn busy. People say passive investments don't exist, Neil, but last thing I'll say is whether you invest in a mutual fund or an index fund or something as basic as simple stock picking, I hope there's some degree of due diligence people do on that. I've been pretty fast to jump into some stock stuff, but stocks, real estate, whatever. Mm-hmm. The most passive of passive investments still require a little upfront work. So I just wanted to mention that because the least work we had ever done to get into what I realized was a fully passive investment. And it was all learning and going forward from there.
I think you touched on something that I find interesting is so often I hear evaluating a deal and understanding real estate, understanding where to place my money into an opportunity as a limited partner takes time, takes energy. It's not all that passive on the front end. And if not this, then what? And then where you're investing someplace else. And most people, stock market's the most common place to churn. And most people can't even explain how it works, can't even understand how a company works, how dividends work, how stock splits work, how any of it even works versus an apartment complex is simplistic to understand. You have a box, someone lives in that box, they pay you for that and you do certain things in return, right? And then with inflation, the way it is, that box costs more next year for them to live there.
Right.
But we get the benefit, right? So when you can do it, I love what you've just touched on there because I think it's people often gloss over that.
Can I add one thing more to that?
Of course.
Thank you for grabbing on that. I've always found it best to just be remarkably upfront in most things in life. In my 20s, as all of us are, when we were younger years, that can be brash. Mm. Perhaps I look back at some as a manager role in my 20s, I look back, I'm like, yeah, that feedback could have been delivered with a little bit more polish. When it comes to being upfront with investing, it's so important to me to just say it plainly. And I love the way you just described real estate investing and even investing in a large apartment community as an example. Or I'm also very keen on storage, for example, and self-storage. So we do a lot of that, but it's just a big box. It's an asset. It's a hard asset. Didn't used to know what that term meant 15 years ago, of course, right, in the right professional terms, but same thing. It has an address. Buy the thing, improve the thing through a couple levers, operations, renovations. That's it. And over time, collect some cash flow and profits and then sell it at a future value. It's a model that's elegant in its simplicity. But I think oftentimes I got hit when I first got into my very first one of these things and you're staring at the legal documents. Mm-hmm. It's a brick wall.
Correct.
There's no other way around it. And I have found that, like, whether it's our fellow investors in our investing club and I'm providing some education for them, just be like, hey, I literally will just tell them, buckle up. I'm so glad you're excited. I'm so glad you see the same numbers and potential outcomes and the quality of this asset and this market and this team that I do. But at the same time, just buckle up. Have you ever read a legal document? Have you ever bought a house? Try to give them something relatable. Like, you look at that home disclosure packet. That's the closest thing I can give right to the average person out there. That's the biggest document you've ever looked at legal wise. So buckle up. You're about to go sign some fields and read some new terminology because that PPM is dense. But once you're in, smooth sailing. Right.
You're spot on. You know, what they don't have you do in the stock world is, although they print a prospectus, you're not required to read it and sign off on it before buying it.
No doubt.
One does if you're agreeing to the terms and policy, which all of us have done online. You click a little box or it pops up terms and policies and procedures and you scroll to what appears to be infinite that almost nobody reads. And you click, I've read this document, and you move on.
Closest thing to it is like the Apple terms of service. When we all add a new phone or upgrade our iPhone, it's like, well, that's a lot of legalese right there.
Right. Yeah. Bring me current on the deal. Tell me about the most recent transaction you were involved in.
Sure. Let's see. Well, we focus on two asset classes, really, within real estate. Love multifamily for all the reasons we've been talking about and more. Also appreciate self-storage. So we've actually been leaning into both of those, but on a more selective basis. And so within self-storage, it was actually a fund with some partners that we've worked with now multiple times. And we've done the single asset stuff in Dallas multiple times with some partners and very pleased with how that's going. But also the self-storage facilities are just a little smaller. And when I say smaller, it's all by comparison to a $60, $80 million, you know, $40 million, whatever apartment building. But fund structures seem to do better for a lot of these self-storage facilities. So that was the most recent one. And it kicked off just at the tail end. I'm sorry, the very beginning of this year. It's been a heck of a year so far. So it blurs. But that brought in, gosh, at least four or five self-storage facilities already into it. And it's the kind of thing that I look at as the best kind of boring when done correctly. I mean, take it even further on storage, not to go too far on the asset. I'll just say analogy we were talking about of the box.
Yeah.
Yeah. An apartment building.
Yeah.
Take it to the nth degree and you got a storage facility.
Yeah.
Big slab of concrete.
It's literal.
Quite literal, right? Even the most sophisticated you're probably going to get is making a climate control, and that's about it. But that was the most recent one. I think take it a step back further. We were doing apartment community also in Dallas, and some of those opportunities that are becoming more interesting because of the reasons that you already know very well about, but for members of the audience too, if they aren't watching this as closely as we are, it's hard to ignore, but interest rates are much higher out there. And as a result, there's some opportunities popping up on the buying side because of some financial distress for sellers. And so that was the most recent apartment community deal that we were actually looking at and bought and invested in. It's something that you like to think about, waited a while to see on the buying side.
Yep.
Because people say, pick a quote from Warren Buffett in terms of be greedy when others are fearful, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But meaningful discounts are popping up. And that's why we were excited about that one.
They're popping up and you've got to go shopping every day though, don't you? You have to be participating. You've got to be active and or working with folks on the GP side who are actively out there turning over the rocks in order to find those opportunities that exist.
That's right. Yeah. And frankly, to exactly your point, years ago, I mean, this is back in 2017, 2016, there was a pivotal point, just to give context for folks, where I was trying to wrestle with how much on the active side did I want to become. And I left my job, my full-time job and career in 2019 because it just became too unwieldy to, and it was a good problem, like managing and helping and serving our fellow investors in our investing club simply was beyond a full-time job at that point in a good way. I had to leave my leadership job, right? And that was before it was cool to do the quiet quitting thing. And that was 5 months before COVID. But active versus passive and what level of involvement, I decided at that point, after talking to a mentor, and he's like, hey man, are you planning on moving back out of state from California again? And the answer was no. And this is all leading up to me basically saying, like, find great partners, to your point, right? Like, find great GPs, find great sponsors, find folks who are capable of going and operating in this environment. Because if you are not physically there as an investor, if you are not the one looking and talking to a broker network and nurturing that broker network who is fighting for these deals, you're not really going to have a shot, because your ear is not to the ground. You don't have a finger on the pulse, whatever other health analogy I can give here, but just keep an eye out for it. But they are starting to pop up. I don't think that's going to be the last. I think we're going to see a heck of a lot more in the next 6 to 12. So, I mean, 6, 12, 18. I'll give my crystal ball disclaimer here. I don't have one like everyone else. But yeah, they're starting to pop up. And I lean on those partnerships, because that's really at the core of what I have found to be why folks find it helpful to like invest alongside us and stuff, is because like, it's not rocket science. It's just a framework for vetting, right? It's like 5 things for vetting. I look at the team. Who's the boots on the ground? Like, have they done it before, AKA track record? Do they have a repeatable process behind that too? Who's on that team? Like, what's the GP team assortment? Like, do they know they're married? Is there 2 or 3 of them? And the legal side, how do they communicate with financial transparency, all those things. And so, and values, as corny as that sounds, we actually do have that officially like within our framework for vetting people, is like, do they have some form of stated philosophy on how they want to treat their tenants? So we look at all that stuff and then lean heavy on the who, because the who, how they decide to go and manage their deals once they fight to acquire them, now more than ever matters greatly, because it's not as easy. You got insurance costs going up in states that we love, like Texas, right? You got insurance in Florida. You got some very volatile economic times. Like, you got to lean on those partners. And I'm not the one who wanted to go out and fly out and change our whole lifestyle and geography to go do that full time. Just that. Got to lean on partnerships. So thanks for indulging the tangent. Just wanted to get some more color behind it.
Are you a passive real estate investor seeking financial freedom? Well, today's market's unique and it's ever changing. Now is the time to get educated on how to strategically invest in commercial real estate for long-term financial freedom. Grab your copy of How to Passively Invest in a Changing Economic Environment. Go to www.mavericksinvest.com. No, I think that helps a lot. I'm curious, for the last 6-7 years of really sinking your teeth into this from start to today, I won't call it finished, start to today, you know, what are the biggest lessons you've learned along the way in going out, in vetting those partners, both partners, and then also from a deal standpoint? So maybe give some color to vetting that partner a little more. And then maybe once your partner passes that test, understanding and analyzing that deal to know that you actually want to be involved in that particular deal with that partner.
Yeah, happy to. First on the who, on the partner, marriage, not dating. This is at the core of what we've done. We've walked away from so many great deals that have come inbound in the past 2 years, I would say, in particular. I mean, it's been happening now for, grateful to say, for about 5 years now, where deals come inbound from great up and coming new sponsors. They say, look at this deal. The economics are killer. Look at this market. All those fundamentals of a great market that you likely appreciate as well, Neil. Strong job growth, population demographics, inbound migration, wage growth, et cetera, all these things. Big corporate foothold, even better if it's government footholds for stability of jobs, et cetera. But on the who, is a repeatable process. And I think that that's a very simplified way of saying, take any skill, take any habit someone has in their personal life, just to make it simple for folks. And like, I've got my nerdy guitar habit in the background here. Like, if I want to learn something and I really know it, I have put some blood, sweat, and tears into know how to play a certain song, even if it's Wheels on the Bus for my kids right now. And if I can't speak to how I did that, just like an operator should be able to speak to, how do they go acquire, take over management of a property, third party, sure. In-house, vertically managed, sure. What is the detailed way that they go do that all the way through the management and disposition of those properties, if they do have the full cycle disposition of their properties, right? And so I think I'm just going deep on one specific example of like repeatable process. I look at it as a sibling of when people say, what's their track record? Because track record just on exits can be pretty misleading.
For sure.
2021 was a hell of a year. I think right now more than ever, leaning into what does a repeatable process truly mean, particularly on things such as, is the team doing renovations? If they're doing renovations, what is their supply sourcing? If they're doing renovations, who is managing it? If they're doing it at scale, how do they make sure that it's on pace, on track, or ahead of schedule? And how do they mitigate those things? One other thing I'll share is like, how open is the team about their misses? And if they are open, what are they willing to share about what's been learned? And that's a kind of a basic sounding thing, Neil, but I think that that's borrowing also from the concept of behavioral interviewing from a corporate career interviewing and hiring and leading hundreds of people. is like, if someone's truly, the only value in having a mistake is if someone has reflected and learned on it.
No doubt.
I can go mess things up, and I do that every day. Mess things up, and my kids will remind me that every day, right? But if I haven't learned anything from it, that is useless. So I think the value of failure response, as nerdy as that sounds, is like failure response is the branding in our templated framework here, is like, they should have a failure response in that muscle memory of, oh, we blew it in that circumstance with that asset. Or even if it's a parallel business, if they're a newer operator, newer sponsor, but they've been kicked in the teeth figuratively, not to be too grim or violent for folks with the analogy, but just really taking a hard hit in entrepreneurship, they will not have any shortage of details about that. But it's when they've glazed over, it's when someone glazes over, that's when I start to get really uncomfortable. So I just wanted to cover kind of track record, but also a little bit of the failure response. There's a 70 rows on that spreadsheet that we use right now, just for the main bullet points, so we won't go into that.
Exactly.
On the deal level, I think right now more than ever is, if it's like multifamily, core principles is to like, okay, are they buying the asset? Is the sponsor buying the asset at an actual discount? And kind of questioning, what does a discount even mean right now? Not to get too philosophical here, right?
We're in a very fluid environment.
Very fluid environment. It's also tricky because repricing of assets can be based or biased from things like, it's a private market, but private market also using things like seller financing tends to prop up what would otherwise be a discount. Like just all kinds of variables, right?
Right.
And all that to say, well, what's the debt structure?
Almost the backbone of a deal today.
Yeah. And I also think that not overcorrecting on it is so much more appealing for all of us as passive investors right now in our reptile brain to say, ooh, I'm looking at this deal. I want a deal that is safe. I want a deal that has something in the debt that says fixed. And there's a double-edged sword there. And I think a lot of folks, particularly within like a value add right now, if they're looking at deals, and if I'm looking at a deal and it's like, oh, cool, I do like fixed rate debt. Clearly, it lets everyone sleep at night. It's also really expensive for people that want to go and do anything in terms of value add and then exit within the maximum time horizon for the hold. So prepayment penalties, et cetera. So it's that type of stuff on the deal level within the debt that I find really important. Who's the lender, et cetera. So I won't go further into that one necessarily. But one other thing I would mention on the deal level is being even more conservative on things such as rent growth. Once we got into around, I look back at deals in 2020, and interesting time, right? Interesting time. And I'm grateful for how that turned out in terms of the real estate asset pricing for the next year and a half. Now we're on the other side of the ramifications there. But if you're looking at the deals now and the rent, like 2020, the rent growth projections changed rapidly within those performers across the market, right? It was like two different halves of 2020. First half was like, hey, 3% out the gates, 5% out the gangbusters. Second half of 2020, it was like zeros for the next 2 years.
Right.
Looking for more of that right now, not necessarily zero, but being focused on what is the right appropriate financial projections. If you're going to go push rents on something, what is the business case and how, and what are the numbers going into those assumptions to really improve the value of that asset and that operating income on that asset?
It makes a lot of sense. You have to pay special attention to those assumptions because they drive so much of that depending on the project, right? Tremendous amount of the value. The overall return is on the basis of these assumptions being true and actually coming to fruition.
Totally.
You work with investors side by side with investors. Tell me a little more about how you work with investors on your investment club too. And then take me into your communication plan. Because I think, you know, my interactions with folks in the environment today, you'll echo it. Communication is critical, especially in some level of uncertainty, you know, uncertain times, if you will. The communication becomes more important during that period.
Well said. Man, do I agree with that, Neil? Increasing frequency of communication is just a great idea during volatile times. And so our regular communication plan, one thing we've done, we do a newsletter. I know a lot of folks do. On our newsletter, just for the overall club level, we actually did two things. Went back to fundamentals and education from an LP lens first, from a passive investor lens first. And this might sound simple, but I really thought the feedback has been shockingly, there's been more of it. And I'd say more positive than I even expected for something so basic. So that's the first thing I'll touch on. The second thing is I started putting together like a very robust quarterly snail mail letter. I know it sounds very traditional, but that's been a labor of love the last couple of quarters. But we've gotten really, really good feedback on that. And I think I'd say half of our club reads it because the other half just says, oh, it's a piece of snail mail. Let's toss it away. But those that read it really appreciate it. The basic passive investor lens that has been well received recently, as simple as this sound, Neil, is like how to look at a deal, like take out the notion of what it means to invest for cash flow versus growth from like a active real estate investor lens for a moment, back into the, let's say I'm coming out as a big tech company employee making $400,000 a year. This is like just me trying to anonymize a couple of profiles of many people in our group. And they know a lot about RSUs. Like they've got a ton of RSUs. They're doing great on multiple 401k or IRAs. Like they are set, but they're looking at a lens of, okay, how do we even begin to evaluate all of these beautiful looking PDF marketing documents that are all showing very nicely photographed apartment buildings in different states that I've never been to or maybe briefly visited? And the fundamental question above that though, is someone going for a goal on cash flow? Or is someone going for a goal? Have they set a goal? A time-bound, simple stuff, like time-bound goal of income or a time-bound goal of growth for their capital. What's the goal for the money? And I've been shocked, as basic as that might sound to you and I find that valuable for myself when I'm evaluating a deal. So that's the kind of stuff we've been hitting on, and more so, and even helping just plot for folks. Everyone typically, if they haven't thought about it, they say, oh, I want a little bit of both. And I've said that plenty of times too. I want growth, I want equity. But right. Not everyone does. Like the real goal for that person might be, I have one kid, I'm making $400,000 a year. If I'm an employee in a big tech company, I'm a data scientist. I have one kid, infant. I have another that's probably coming in the next year or two. I have a generation older than me parent that's living in our household. I probably want to pivot out from my career within 5 to 7 years fully. And when I ask, what's your goal? And they say, well, I want a blend of growth and cash flow. I'm like, well, okay. Have you run the numbers? What's the dollar amount? And they haven't done that. And there's nothing wrong with that. Most people haven't done that.
Right.
But that's where I challenge folks, is just be like, don't rush into a deal. Just don't rush into a deal until you've sat down, at least thought about that. Like just why are you going to go park $50,000 or like $100,000 or like $200,000, $300,000, whatever the number is for this individual to go do what they do. And then they get the more fun conversation, which I think is fun, about depreciation losses and how that's a role as well, but like cash flow growth and depreciation. So I don't know, it might be too basic, but I think folks have found that to be incredibly helpful in addition to just market context, market education. One more thing to say on the deal level, which I think is at the core of what you're getting at potentially, is like, if something's not going perfectly, because there are deals where it's like, well, yeah, the debt service on this deal is really high. Interest rate caps are in place. NOI is looking killer, looking really good. This distribution has to be paused. That's just a fact of the matter. And being upfront with folks, being available to explain that, like why that is, that was a 6-page snail mail letter that I put together back in Q2 when I saw where the market was going. And I was like, this is going to happen more. This is just going to happen more. I've exited 2 already full cycle deals personally that had paused distributions in COVID, one of which ended up being, I think ultimately in our group, one of these 2 deals ended up being the best performing of any property we've ever been in touch, we've ever been involved with. So like a short-term cash flow related issue is scary. It makes someone question the investment and the asset. And in the end, if as long as there's the debt structure and the interest rate caps in place, these are the types of topics that are really helpful to educate folks more through. So I went a bit further there than I intended to, but hopefully it was helpful.
No, I think it's terrific. And you know, COVID obviously is the first thing that comes to mind. And for those who have interest or exposure down south, you touched on it. The insurance in many cases, I've got friends who have indicated to me in parts of Florida, insurance has tripled. Before you know it, it's a 6-figure increase in insurance. It's a material hit to the cash flow of the property. I suspect over a period of time, getting rent growth, there's other things in there to offset that over a period of time. But as you said, there may be a temporary event that has to be addressed today. It doesn't mean it's permanent though.
Yeah, triple sounds like the norm, right? Tripling insurance costs. It's a key change that was fascinating to witness on the marketing decks and the pro formas that we've been seeing in the market for the past 6-12 months, is that now suddenly you're seeing deliberate, communicated proactively, really smart move from sponsors to say, here's the tax attorney we've already hired. Here's the worst expected best case financially of what they assured us that they can get in terms of fighting for the lowest possible tax burden on this property. And that's, you did not see that, at least on many of the pro formas and investment summaries and offering memorandums of the earlier, I should say like 2018, 2017, et cetera. So that's a big change, and it's appropriate for those states, I think.
Spencer, what are you most excited about this year?
Man, I'm most excited just about leaning into the buying opportunity. Yeah. I think that taking a long view in life is helpful 100% of the time. I can't say that about many parts of life, but I think taking the long view, my goodness, it brings me back to center anytime I need it, whether it's about being a parent, an entrepreneur, anything about family, et cetera, but certainly in investing, taking the long view. Example, we need more housing in America. Obvious statement, clearly, but I do think that folks tend to get really scared, as we all do. I succumb to it too, in moments where volatility rears its head, same as in 2020, different moment now. And right now, as I've shared with many different members of our group and our investors, gosh, this brilliant quote, and I don't know who to give credit to, Neil, but it was that there's no such thing as bad assets. There's just bad prices. And that could be applied to anything. That's why I love it. It's just an elegant way of saying you could apply that to a pen, to a car, to a 400-unit apartment building. Yeah. And right now, we're entering a buying period for the assets that you and I appreciate, many of the listeners most likely. So making sure just to keenly pay attention and be ready for it, because exactly your really well-stated point earlier, Neil, I do think timing and speed and paying attention matters. And so knowing if someone's out there and they want to participate and they're trying to figure out how, just making sure that they've built the right network, that they're actually actively engaging with folks. So I'm fired up about that moment. I'm fired up about looking beyond whatever current headwinds. But I also think it's worth reminding folks, and I have to remind myself about this too, we've had a pretty wonderful run of prosperity. And so let's all be realistic coming back to earth as to how good we've got it and how good we've had it. And we're still all doing much better than I think we are right now in a lot of circles.
I agree with that, but I echo there with you. There's a lot of opportunities that are forthcoming. It's going to be exciting. Let's do this. I want to move on to the final segment, what I call the final four. What do you think holds most passive investors back from hitting their next level, their personal next level, whatever that happens to be?
I pause because this is such an important question. And I think what holds all of us back as passive investors is that sitting down and starkly or plainly, simply, where it is here, look at the facts, look at where you are, look at your numbers, look at your goals, and then look at where you want to be. And I think that that's honestly where most people are held back. And that's where I'm held back often, is that we're too afraid to hold up the mirror to current and then just stare at it for a moment. Whether that's, oh, here's the passive income number I want. Here's the passive income number I want to be at. Some people don't invest passively for income. The wealthier folks in particular, right? High net worth folks, they don't really need the additional income. They're looking at it as a de-risking mechanism. So what holds them back, I would say, is there needs to be a way for them to kind of sit there and go, well, why am I still deploying here? Am I doing it towards a certain net worth target? Am I doing it for a certain diversification percentage? Am I doing it because I didn't get enough depreciation losses last year, but I need enough this year to offset something? That is always the hardest thing, because it requires not being lazy. For a passive investor inherently is going to sit there in their mind thinking, I want to be passive, therefore I don't want it to raise my hand up using my computer and do this little bit of due diligence. I get it. I really, really get it. I'm living it. I get it. But that's exactly when you need to lean in more, because it means that if you're feeling lazy, when I'm feeling lazy about those types of topics, it means I haven't set goals that motivate me clearly enough. And that's where it starts, is just holding up the mirror.
What are you passionate about outside of real estate?
I think I mentioned earlier, we were just coming back from this kind of 6-week experience living abroad. It was pretty cool. And I bring this up on this top question because it was through a program that my wife found a chance for our boys to go to a school during the day, show them a new way to learn, more global perspective, et cetera. And we were also in a cohort with like 28 other families from different parts of the world, heavy on the US, got the UK, got Japan, got, you know, all over Australia. All these different parents and all these different families were trying to figure out a way to simply answer the question. And this is my synopsis of what is enough, right? And talk about a head spinner question. Mm-hmm. I don't claim to have that answer. I'll always be chasing it. But in the end, I think what drives me now and what I think is ultimately something I'm passionate about, even though it is related to, like, it's enabled by passive investing, is frankly, like, just connecting with other folks who are going through that same type of journey and helping share those learnings and figure out, well, what does it mean to be, the buzzwordy term would be digital nomad, being able to live from anywhere, work from anywhere, but also adding value back into the real world at the same time and doing it. Maybe that means for a profit. Maybe that means for nonprofit. Maybe that means charitable. Maybe that means just ultimately being a better parent and having that be the number one priority of the day. And that's been a huge focus within our household. We made all these changes in our life from being two full-time, hardworking, 13-year career professional parents and changed everything in service of building this new path. And so that's what I'm passionate about, in addition to plucking a guitar behind me and nerding out every once in a while.
Your favorite book?
Whew. Best business book, most effective for me, Essentialism by Greg McKeown. Just, I think I've gone through it 3 times now. Teaches you 5 ways of saying no with social grace in service of higher priority. Man, I think best book be on the nonfiction or on the fiction front gosh, this is going to be so nerdy, but I love sci-fi, man. So it's still going to go all the way back to stuff that's like the Ender's Game series and stuff. You know, this is really nerdy sci-fi stuff. It's all that on the personal front.
What's your favorite way to make an impact in the community?
Sharing knowledge transparently in the best way that I can. And I think leaning more into that, looking further into 2023 and in 2024, just trying to figure out how to scale that a bit more. And doing that in a way that is actually accessible for people, because it's a beautiful modern world that we live in right now. You can add so much value. You could teach so much, and you can do it in ways that is relatively scalable and add value without necessarily making it something that is gated for people in a prohibitive way. And so I think being able to just be available for folks without expectation of any kind of return has always been, ever since inception of this club, the number one thing that I feel like I've been able to help with is coaching without being a coach, as it were.
This has been a great conversation. I've enjoyed this a lot. To hear your journey from all the way through fintech and your exposure to that world for 13 years, and then how you got into real estate, really on the active side, if you will, from what I would deem, because I owned them too, single family homes, active, they're not really passive, they're active rentals, and then finally found your home in passive investing inside of apartments and inside of storage. For people who want to find you, they want to follow you, they want to connect with you, where can they go? What should they do?
Yeah, and this has been a pleasure. So thank you for the wonderful discussion.
You're welcome.
Folks can find me at madisoninvesting.com. That's our website. We've got plenty of information, educational stuff we're putting up there regularly on the blog, but also they can sign up to talk with me and just potentially join our investor club. So yeah, reach out.
No, wonderful. The links are below in the show notes for everybody. Spencer, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Neil. Really appreciate it.
To our listeners, pat yourself on the back. You guys have made it to the end of the show, and most people never finish what they start. If you receive value from today's show, be sure to share it on LinkedIn, your Facebook page, or your social media platform of choice. Subscribe to never miss a valuable episode in the future. And if you found value in today's episode, give us a thumbs up with a positive review. If there's a particular topic you'd like to hear about, well, I want to hear from you. Shoot me a message on LinkedIn. The link to my profile is below in the show notes. You can connect with me there for more valuable content.